online, on smart speakers, and on Listen Again. This is Food FM.
Drinking Hour with David Kermode in partnership with Club Onologique, the world through the lens of wine and spirits.
This week, democratizing wine, giving the consumer a say in how it's made. Alex Brogan was recently named winner of the IWSC's Emerging Talent in Wine Award. He joins me to talk about his not yet named wine co. The wine world can sometimes seem a bit baffling, even intimidating to those on the outside. But if Alex Brogan has his way, that is going to change. Named as winner of the IWSC's hotly contested Emerging Talent in Wine trophy, sponsored by London Wine Fair, for his not yet named wine co, he was lauded for his effort to democratize the way the wine is made. It's a process of which consumers are in control. They are his members, effectively, in return for investing in the wine. The project has already resulted in two wines yet to be released, and a third could be on the way. To find out more, let's chat to Alex. Welcome to The Drinking Hour, Alex.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I've listened to a few of our podcasts and enjoyed them quite a lot.
Oh, God. Well, you're saying all the right things. So, listen, what you've done is really very interesting and exciting. And before we come to it and sort of your best to explain it, just tell us a little bit about your own wine journey so far.
Yeah, so actually my wine journey started quite a long time ago, maybe sort of 10, 12 years ago. I worked at Majestic. It was first job out of university. Didn't know what I wanted to do exactly, and it seemed like a fun job to do. So spent a couple of years there, absolutely loved it, really fell in love with wine especially. But then unfortunately, they give you a taste for stuff that you then can no longer afford. So I decided to have a little career change, move into something a little less interesting for the last 8 or 9 years. But then I always had it somewhere in the back of my mind that I wanted to return to wine. That was always my dream. And I spent a bit of time just saving up some money, thinking about how to get back into it. And it was actually in 2018 when I took a year out from my job to travel around. I did a couple of harvests, one in Bordeaux and then one in Chile. And at that point, I realized I actually just want to make wine. That's what I want to do. So yeah, saved a bit of money and then joined Plumpton College, do a degree in viticulture and enology.
And that is now complete, I believe, isn't it?
No, not at all, actually. Oh. I'm actually one and a half years through it. So, yeah, so in the summer at the end of my first year, we set up Not Yet Named Wine Co. And actually, because of the, I guess, it's gone better than we expected, I've actually gone down to part-time because, you know, I want to focus a bit more on the business. So I've still got another 3.5 years to go before I'm finished at Plumpton.
Good God. Well, you are already seriously accomplished for someone who's still doing their enology studies, it has to be said. So tell me how the idea for Not Yet Named Wine Co., which is a bit of a mouthful, tell me how it came about.
So as you said, like I was a first-year student, and it was myself and Manuel, another student at the college. We sat down one day in the canteen, and we were, like all winemakers at Plumpton or all winemakers anywhere who are just starting out, you want to make your own wine. That's what you want to do. That's the dream. And the normal path into getting into winemaking is you'd be an intern for a few years, you know, do a few harvests, get it under your belt, then become an assistant. And then hopefully if that goes well a few years later, you might be a winemaker with an enologist telling you what to do. And it's a bit of a ladder to get to the top. So we just had this idea of, well, how can we just do our own thing? Really, what we thought we needed was a bit of money to be able to buy grapes and rent equipment, which we didn't have. So we needed a bit of an innovative way to get that money in, effectively.
It's a kind of form of crowdfunding, but unlike a lot of crowdfunding, which is just, please give me some money, this is comes with a sense of participation and, of course, a reward at the end of it.
Yeah, exactly. I've I've thought about whether this was a crowdfunding model or not for a lot, and I've never got to a definitive answer because it is a little bit, you are investing in a couple of young winemakers trying to make their way, but also you are just buying wine, right? You'll get six bottles at the end of it. It's, yeah, and an experience and a journey along the way. So I think I'm leaning towards calling it just a normal product that you buy. It's just you don't get the finished product straight away, but you go straight into the experience.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough because, as I say, crowdfunding comes in all sort of shapes and sizes. Sometimes it's, you know, please help me with my Master of Wine studies. Sometimes it's please invest in this innovative business. Sometimes you don't know a great deal about that business. But yours is pretty straightforward. You're taking part in a process, having a say in that process, and then getting your reward at the end of it. The wine. That's the kind of nutshell version. Just give us a bit more detail for those listening who might want to take part themselves on how it works, what you're expected to do and what you get.
Yeah, so the overall concept is that, yeah, we sell the wine before it's made. It's almost like on premier, but it's before on premier. So we tend to joke that it's a pre-on premier offering. And you buy six bottles, you buy half a case, and then in exchange, you get a vote in how we make the wine. So every time us as winemakers come across a decision that we would make ordinarily, we send an email to our members that explains all the pros and cons of a decision, the sort of the risks, crucially, I guess, the impact on taste. And then we let people decide on how we make the wine. We only provide good options and we sort of decide those options. But then people can choose pretty much exactly how we make the wine from starting out, you know, grape variety through to picking date, whether we do it earlier or later, whether we add yeast or what specific yeast we add to the ferment, all the decisions through the winemaking until it's ready. And then alongside that, we also do a bit more of the less serious stuff. I say less serious, the non-winemaking stuff. People also get to name the wine, hence why we're called Not Yet Named Wine Co. They get to design the label, they decide whether it's a screw cap or a cork, or whether we wax the top, even some really daft stuff like the music that we play to the barrels, just to keep it interesting as well. It's not all technical winemaking, it's also a bit of fun.
This idea of having the winemaking process kind of democratized in this way initially struck me as completely bonkers. I've told you that before. In fact, I said it in front of an audience at the London Wine Fair. I think I'm wrong. I think I was just being overcautious. What sort of reaction have you had? Have you had many people who've kind of questioned the sanity of this process?
A few people, but I'm also quite a cautious person myself. And this idea was in my head for a long time. And I think I went through every permutation of what could happen and what would go wrong. So when I start to explain it to people, I think I pretty much had an answer to other people's concerns because I had those same concerns myself. And actually, some of those concerns are sort of real and still exist in terms of it's not necessarily the way a winemaker would go about making the best possible wine. Like ideally, and it's true of anything, right? You want to start with a plan and go through that step by step and adjust if necessary. But this doesn't allow us to plan in the same way. I think we originally did try to do a little tree diagram of all the permutations and how it could end up, but it got very complicated very quickly. So we just decided to wing it. And it has worked. And I guess our focus is on the experience and learning the winemaking process as much. So if the wine isn't top notch, then it's less important. However, you know, I think we've been lucky, certainly with the first vintage, that it has turned out to be pretty good.
This is the key, I think. You know, looking at the emails you send out, and we'll come to the way you explain things in a minute, because it's really good. But you are basically being invited to kind of go on a winemaking journey with people who are still learning themselves. I mean, that's fair, isn't it?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's how we write the emails. So as somebody who's relatively inexperienced with making their own wine, when it comes to decision, if I know something's coming, I'll really study it. Like I'll get the scientific journals. I'll be reading the trusted textbooks that Plumpton provided with us. And I make notes on what I would do and the various options and what might happen if we adopt different techniques or not. And then from these notes, I pretty much just drop them into the email. So it is exactly what I'm learning and what I'm thinking. It's very much my, you know, like a brain dump of what's going through my head when I'm thinking of the options for a decision. just without all of the responsibility of having to make that decision at the end.
You mentioned that obviously you don't want to screw up the wine, so therefore you're not giving completely batshit crazy options to your followers, members, whatever you call them, fellow kind of journey goers. But I mean, when you're giving those options, they are genuine options. So you could, as a follower, member, whatever you call them, you could really significantly impact the wine with a decision that you're invited to vote on, couldn't you?
Yes, exactly. That's what I guess it's one of our main tenets is that we want to keep every vote interesting and impactful. There are a couple of votes that we've had in the past, which we just do for interest rather than like can actually change the wine significantly. But generally, yeah, we want them to be different and we want people to, you know, to have a bit of a fight over things. Like we like people in their community talking to each other and the members. And it took us ages to work out exactly what we'd call them. And we settled on members, but it's not quite perfect. But yeah, they're our members currently. We give them decisions that really do impact the style of the wine. And I think that's the key. It's always the style of the wine, because sometimes there are decisions that we take that we don't put to vote, which are purely based on quality. So as a very inexperienced winemaker, I'd be very reluctant to use no sulfites at all and go down the natural route. And not to say I wouldn't do or that I'm not a fan of it. And potentially if we were to work with a partner winery who are skilled in that type of winemaking, then we might do it. But sulfites, we added a little bit to our first wine and it wasn't a vote just because I wanted it to be clean, safe and drinkable. So that was an example of a decision that we didn't give to the members.
Okay. And for those listening who are aware of sulfites, but don't necessarily know why they are in almost all wines, well, certainly naturally occurring ones are, but they're generally added to most commercial wines. Just explain, because you're very good at explaining things in the emails you send out to the members, just explain why sulfites are important, what they do, and their effect.
Yes, I mean, so sulfites do two main things, right? One side, they are antimicrobial. So if there's any bad bacteria, I guess, living in the grapes, that you don't necessarily want to produce any byproducts that will impact the flavour. You'll want to get rid of those, certainly. And then additionally, it's also an antioxidant. So generally, a lot of winemaking is about oxidation management and managing the amount of oxygen that gets to your wine. And there's lots of processes you do in winemaking that open up the grapes and the juice to oxygen. And sulfites just give you that little bit of protection, because sometimes you think you might as well have a stable wine, but if the pH changes for some reason, or just even a simple temperature change as it's being shipped, that can chemically change a lot of things. And sulfites just sort of manage it very nicely. But then at the same time as well, I read a paper fairly recently about the things that cause you headaches in wine. And sulfites is one of the things, but it only impacts a very small percentage of the population. And then on the other hand, you also get some histamines in wine, which similarly affect a very small percentage of the population. But sulfites inhibit the growth of those histamines. So, you know, you can get a headache from sulfites, but you can also get a headache from no sulfites. So it's a tricky one.
And there's an example of a decision that you felt was sufficiently important that you didn't put it to a vote, because otherwise you'd have effectively ended up making a wine that was potentially unstable. Give us an example of a decision that is entirely democratic, but also fundamental to the wine. One of the most important decisions that you do give to your members.
Yeah, so I think if I look at vintage one, vintage one was in Portugal and we made an Alvarinho. Our partner wine, Soleiro, are Alvarinho specialists. So we started with that as our base. We're going to make an Alvarinho. And I'd say probably the decision that had the biggest impact on the wine was probably the vessel that we would ferment and age the wine in. So we gave our members four options. We gave them the stainless steel tank for sort of a classic, crisp, fresh, fruity style of wine. We offered them a French oak barrel, a few years old, that would impart a little bit of toasty vanilla, some extra oak compounds into the wine and allow the wine to develop with that slight ingress of oxygen. And then also a chestnut barrel, which doesn't quite have the same depth of flavour that a French oak barrel would do, but it gives you that oxidation, which rounds and softens the wine. So three very different styles. And actually, we also offered a a fairly innovative glass cube, but I think that spooked a few members. So we just went for, they voted for 50%, sorry, 50% of them voted for stainless steel. 25 wanted French oak and 25 wanted the chestnut barrels. And in normal situations, actually, we go with the majority, but this was actually a very nice opportunity to split our wine. So we went in with those exact proportions. It was a bit of a direct, what was it, proportional representation vote. Yeah. So 50% of our wine went into stainless steel, 25 into French oak, 25 into chestnut. And that was not our final blend, but that was the basis of how we fermented and aged the wine.
Yeah, I was going to say, we're into a conversation about voting reform here, rather than, first past the post and all that. But anyway, that's a separate conversation. You have kind of answered my next question, which was, you're now on vintage two. You've just talked briefly about vintage one there. So what have you set out to make? Number one was an Alvarinho in Portugal. And then vintage two, you went off to Chile, didn't you?
Yeah, exactly. And the place we went to there, called La Despensa Boutique in Colchagua in Chile, they, as opposed to Soleri, who are an Alvarinho specialist in La Despensa, they have a few grape options. So we just said, this time we're going to make a red wine from Chile. And then the first vote was based on the varietals. And they do Syrah, Grenache, Mourvedre, a bit of Marsalan, Sonso, a few different Rhone varietals. So for this wine, they had a choice of which grapes to pick at the beginning. And it actually followed a similar vote to the vessel, in that we ended up with a blend and we co-fermented 60% Syrah, 20% Grenache, a little bit of Sonso, and then a touch of Viognier at the end.
That was a democratic decision, that mix.
Yeah, again, that was another proportional representation vote, which I love because it means everyone's a winner in some way.
It's interesting that your members wanted that dash of Viognier in there.
Yeah, that was actually an addition to the original blend, and it was an opportune decision that we weren't necessarily expecting. I was just walking through the vineyard one day, and Matt, the guy who owns it, we were just looking at some Viognier in the corner, and he hadn't quite got enough yield to make his own wine out of it or include it in his blends. So I just said, can we have a bit of that? Like, it's an interesting technical vote as well, because amongst other things, like, Viognier does give freshness to a red blend, but also weirdly stabilizes the color. So you get a deeper red from adding the white grape. So I definitely wanted that vote just to explain this weird chemistry about co-pigmentation, how Viognier can make a red deeper in color. So we offered it, and the members said, yes, please.
And that is an age-old technique in the Rhone, of course, isn't it? Particularly with one of the most famous wines in the world, Châteauneuf-du-Pape. That often has a splash of Viognier in, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And Côte-Rôtie and a few places around there. And I think, that's the standard we're aspiring to. And I think, this one tastes pretty similar to one of those top-end Côte-Rôties or Châteauneuf-du-Papes.
Wow. Okay. Well, I was going to say, your members, it's a leap of faith. And I know there are a lot of them, I think probably the overwhelming majority, who have stayed with you for project number two, but they have not yet tasted wine number one, have they?
Exactly. And that is the biggest concern, not concern, but when we first started was, how do we convince people to buy vintage two when they haven't tried vintage one? And actually, our first wine, which is probably a couple of months away now, it's just getting through approval of labeling and stuff at the minute, is proving a little bit trickier than we expected. So it could well be the case that I'll be asking for people to sign up to vintage three before vintage one has even arrived. So that will be a true test of whether people are bought into the full concept.
And when they buy in, what are they paying?
So for the first vintage, we did six bottles for £150. So that was... £25 a bottle is one way that I think people look at it. But I'm also really trying to change people's minds on that, because I mean, people have different views on it. But I think for me, I see it as half experience and then half wine. So it's not really £25 a bottle. It's probably more like £12.50 per bottle, which is pretty good value for wine these days. But then you get the experience and the education and the learning and the fun and the chance to be part of our community. That makes up the rest of the cost. And then for Chile, it's a little bit more expensive. So we went to 180 for six. And then for vintage three, I'm yet to price it, but we, fingers crossed, could be going to California. So the cost of the wine will be a little bit higher, but I'm looking at ways of not passing that on to the customer.
Oh, really? That's very decent of you. Can you tell us anything more about Vintage 3 in California yet, or is it still under wraps?
It's a little bit under wraps. It's we still have a few things to sort out with the contracts and stuff, just a dotting of the I's, crossing of the T's thing. But it's in California. It's a region I'm excited about because I've tried very little wine from there. But a place called Livermore, sort of east of San Francisco, about an hour and a half away from from San Francisco. And I'm also seeing that potentially as a nice little trip for our members to go out there and visit other regions, for the wine regions in the area. So I think one of the most successful things that actually happened from Vintage One was the school trip that we organized out to Portugal in February of this year, where we took 20 or so of our members to actually go and taste the wine in those three vessels. As I mentioned, we had wine in the stainless steel, the chestnut, and the French oak. And they went out, tried each one individually, and we set up a little competition where we got them into teams, and then they all created their own blend, which was then tasted blind, and the winning blend became our blend for the first edition of Not Yet Named Winecoe.
The field trip is a great idea, actually, in terms of the educational aspect of it, for want of a better word. Presumably, that was rather challenging, trying to do anything like that for Chile.
Yes. I mean, we've still not completely ruled it out. I think the blending is slightly different in that we just have the same wine, so there's not necessarily a blending opportunity. We co-fermented everything together, and then they went into the same barrels. They were both 2019 vintages. So the two barrels that we have shouldn't be too different. So there's not necessarily the same blending opportunity that we had in the first time. And also it's a lot further away. Even once you get to Santiago, it's another 4 hours drive south. So I don't know how viable that will be as a trip. But I will put it to a vote. You know, I'll ask people if they want to go to Chile, and if they do, then maybe we'll go.
Well, yeah, it is very expensive to get there at the moment as well. But you have very engaged members, and that's partly because you're so good at explaining things. You say you often write these emails when you're quite tired, you've had a full day already, but it doesn't feel like that when you read them. You're really kind of good at explaining things. Is that, do you think, just because it's all quite fresh still for you?
Yeah, it could be, and you're right. Like I at the minute I'm in quite a good position where I really am marrying the theoretical and the practical, and I do read what I should be doing just before I do it. So I think you're right, like it's fresh, and it's not necessarily bound by having made a wine for a long time that there's things that you implicitly understand that you don't necessarily share, because you just think, I don't know, you think that, not that everybody knows it, but it's just because it's second nature to you as an experienced winemaker, you might not think that it needs to be explained. Whereas for me, I guess I'm still learning it from the bottom. So I perhaps I explain everything.
You do, and as I say, really well. You know, a lot of wine education, frankly, and I did it as a second career. I found it a bit of a struggle. I said when I was talking to you and the other shortlisted finalists from the Emerging Talent competition this year at the IWSC, there are three people sitting on a page, on a stage rather, all of whom are, really very good at explaining things. And actually, when I was learning about winemaking and doing my diploma, I found it quite difficult. And I found sometimes that some of the joy was sort of sucked out of wine for me. But you seem to have a very fresh approach to being able to explain this. Do you think wine education, frankly, could be better in this country?
Yes, yeah, possibly in certain ways. But at the same time, I do think the drier education that might be exam-based at the end almost needs to be structured and clear and, I guess, less entertaining, because it needs to be consistent, because people are being examined at the end of it, and their careers are defined by grades they get. So it needs to be very structured and organized and consistent. Whereas we're not bound by that. There's no exam. It's just learning things that are interesting. So I probably don't necessarily cover the full breadth of things, but I go into the depth on the stuff that's just interesting, you know? So I'm not bound by having to explain everything. I just tend to explain the interesting things. So maybe that helps. But then I guess I also think my approach to the education side of it is more just to make it entertaining as well. Like, we do go quite deep in some of the technical information, Again, partially because I need to know it for myself. But then to retain the focus of the people reading it, I try and just intersperse some daft pictures, some captions with some jokes, and just things that make the whole thing entertaining and fun, so that, you know, that learning just sort of is next to it, you know, and you're not tired. You're not sitting down thinking, right, I have to learn something. You're sitting down thinking, oh, this is interesting. And then, you know, the education sort of falls into the same bracket. And the way that we structure our emails is much like that. We have almost three or four different sections. The first section being for people who are just very busy, who get a lot of emails, who don't have the time to read these things. It's just a very simple, this is the vote that might impact the wine. This is how it will affect the taste. And then you can vote. And then the next section will be a few pictures about what we're doing, some explanations. And also, as people get the chance to vote, they also have an option to have, there's a free text box with the vote, so people can submit sometimes their justifications as to why they've chosen an option, sometimes complaining that an option wasn't available, sometimes just telling me a joke, other times sending me some abuse for no reason. But I publish all of this stuff in the following emails just to create that community so people can sort of interact with each other as well and talk about what's happening. And then we go into longer, detailed technical information about winemaking, which is there if you want it. But if you don't feel like reading it, then that's fine. You don't have to. Yeah, it's not a requirement that you read everything. But if you want to and you've got the time, then by all means, I hope you enjoy it.
There are still significant kind of hurdles, barriers to entry, if you like, for people who want to enjoy wine. You still sell bottles of wine. So what could kind of the industry more generally learn from what you're doing, do you think, in terms of how people can be enthused by wine rather than intimidated by it?
Yeah, so again, yeah, this came up on the panel, didn't it, where we were talking about that, you know, it's difficult for people to get into wine, and sometimes they're put off by people who have been in the wine industry for a long time, who talk in a certain way that's difficult to understand. And I think often there's lots of people as well who are trying to demystify wine, make it simple and help people understand it more easily, which is great. And there's lots of people doing that in lots of ways. But I think where I slightly differ with that view is that I think it's better to get more people together. So the people who are perhaps considered intimidating or snobbish, I quite like to have them as my members and get them talking to people who aren't. And that conversation between people who are further along in their wine journey and people just starting out, I think it's really interesting, and getting them to challenge each other and talk about why they like certain things. Again, it came up on the panel that we were talking about Chablis as a wine, and some people will only drink Chablis, and people coming in say, well, why do you only drink Chablis? There's so many different styles and varieties and things. But actually, Chablis is like a quite diverse region in itself, and it's got a long history, and it's unique and varied. And it's not a bad thing to only want to drink Chablis, but I almost want that Chablis drinker to explain to somebody who's just joined the wine industry why they like that and have a conversation, and maybe they'll change each other's minds or maybe not. But I think, yeah, the wine, like any hobby, gets more complicated as you get into it and more technical, which is a good thing. You know, I see it the same as with a piece of art. You can go to an art gallery and look at something and just enjoy it for the beauty that you see. But if you learn a bit of context about the artist and the period of time in which it was painted or drawn or whatever, you learn a lot more and it becomes more interesting. But it's not to say that you can't enjoy it at the beginning as you can at the end. But I think your enjoyment does increase the more you know and the more you learn.
Yeah, really good point. And interesting you talk about Chablis, because there are people in the trade who kind of laugh at those people who say, oh, I can't stand Chardonnay, but I love a Chablis. And I've always thought, well, don't laugh at them, because actually they're actually making, although they're not necessarily knowing it, they're making an observation about a style of wine when they're talking about Chablis, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. And Chablis is a unique Chardonnay, so it's not surprising that people see that. You know, Chablis is very different to other Chardonnays. So, yeah, it's tricky. But at the same time, if somebody doesn't know that Chablis Chardonnay, when they learn, then it could open up a whole new world of different drinks for them. So,
yep, absolutely. Let's talk about winning the IWSC Award, Emerging Talent in Wine. It was hotly contested. I know, because I was on the judging panel. I was honoured to be doing that. How did it feel to win that?
Yeah, like a bit of a surprise. It was just one of our members who submitted, I guess, the application on my behalf. So that came as a bit of a surprise that I was shortlisted. And then I sent off a quick video explaining what we were doing. And then a couple of weeks later, again, I wasn't really following it too much. So then I was put onto the shortlist with other great candidates. So, you know, we were talking to a couple the other day, Ellen at Sourcing Table and Louisa, who's doing the canned wine with Brixton Wine Club and the Wine Tap Band. Are these really great, I guess, competitors who are doing phenomenal things. So yeah, it was a privilege to win and just a bit of a surprise. We weren't privy to the process of how it happened. We just got the announcement via Instagram that you've won, which was, yeah, phenomenal.
So you've won an accolade. You also won a bit of dosh as well. You have to do something very specific with it, which is travel. What are you going to do with the prize?
Yeah, so I've asked the London Wine Fair as well about the travel aspect of that, because, and I sort of alluded to it earlier in a very covert way, but what I'm hoping to do, because the Vintage 3, and if it ends up being in California, which is likely, the cost of the wine is higher. So what I've asked London Wine Fair is, rather than use the money for actual travel, whether we can support the price and offer a sort of a London Wine Fair discount using the money that was originally intended for travel to try and lower the price for people. So that's my current intention, is to use that money to get more people involved in the project to make it a little bit cheaper.
Well, that sounds like a very admirable way of using it. Not that it's my decision. And what's your ambition for not yet named Wine Co. Longer term? Is this sort of scalable, do you think, what you're doing?
Yeah, I think it's really scalable. And actually, I'll go back to my original intention with Not Yet Named Wine Co. It wasn't to be scalable or to grow or to be a big business. It was just generally to try and get, during my 3 years at Plumpton, to try and get six different harvests under my belt with having made my own wine and having had that funded by selling the wine. So that was my original intention. It was just going to be, can I get this thing to last for six vintages? But with the success of the first and the second, I think I'm more tempted now to grow it, and I will definitely continue doing it as long as there's demand. And we also have the ability to branch out into loads of different things. You know, we could do not yet named beer, not yet named cider. There's no reason why this process can't be applied to other products. We'll continue to partner with different wineries all around the world, hopefully in England one day. I'd love to do something certainly in London, and then get our members actually hands-on involved with the production, as well as not just remote voting. I think that would be a really cool thing to do. And then someone mentioned it the other day to me. They said, yeah, when are you going to buy your own vineyard? When are you going to have a not-yet-named vineyard? And that's a much more complicated proposition, but it could well be a dream that we move into the viticulture side of things rather than just the winemaking. But that's massively complex and a long way down the road, but it's good to dream, you know.
You're kind of living the dream in a sense with your winemaking journey. What's your kind of long-term goal for yourself? Because, you know, you're learning winemaking as you go, but when you're an accomplished winemaker, are you still going to be interested in, you know, what other people think and having the process democratized, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I think, well, again, whilst there's demand, I'd love to keep doing it. I find it really entertaining. I love the comments that come back every time we send a vote out. Like, they're very funny people, our members. I do love the jokes they tell me. So it does get you closer to the people who are consuming your wine at the end, which I don't think I'd ever want to lose that. And there is an element of this process that means it's not yours. And to be fair, it's not. It's the members' wine. But the way we set this up as well was, every time we sell or make a bottle of wine, we actually make our own alongside. So we've done our Alvarinho that will be the members' wine and only available to the members who've bought that. But we made more wine than we needed. And with that extra wine, we'll be labelling that under our own name and should be available in the summer. So I think we will continue to run Not Yet Named Wine Co. whilst also doing our own little wines in each location along the way. And I think that would be...
It's a really interesting model that you've developed. Fascinating, actually. I normally ask winemakers, you know, if they have a winemaking philosophy. You're a winemaker. I don't know if you've yet got a philosophy, but there's the question. How would you answer that at this stage in your career?
Yeah, you're right. I absolutely don't have a philosophy. And I mean, my background in wine was Majestic, where they have the full range of styles. And I love the variety of wine. So I almost actively don't want to have a philosophy for quite a long while. And what we do when we go to each partner winery around the world, we almost adopt their philosophy. So we will make a wine in their style, broadly speaking. And that's just a way for me to learn about how different people make different wines. So for as long as possible, I really want to avoid having my own philosophy. But I'm sure at some point I'll get some ideas of things I like and things I don't. I'm already a little bit taken with fermenting whole bunch reds. So that might become a thing. But for now, I want to just be led by our partner wineries and our members.
What is it about whole bunch that excites you so much, by the way?
It's the boring side of it. It's the impact on the kinetics of fermentation. It allows you to keep the cap a lot cooler without punching down. But I think stylistically, in terms of the end product, it gives you a different fruit profile for me. You get a little bit of fermentation in the berries, which creates a much lighter fruit, more of a blueberry type fruit. So if you add a little bit of whole bunch into like normal destemmed fruit, you get some darker fruits and some lighter fruits. And I quite like that complexity, that sort of change in profile across the fruit.
Yeah, I do too. Talking of which, the other question that normally gets shot the way of our winemaking guests is a desert island wine. If you're stuck, well, you've listened to the podcast, so you might be expecting this question, but if you're stuck on a desert island and you can have only one wine, what's it going to be?
Well, is that one style of wine or one particular producer?
It's really a fancy pants way of saying, you know, what's your favorite wine? What's the best wine you've ever had? What would that one wine be? And I know you like your variety, but you can't just say all.
Okay, the one wine producer that blew me away was David Deband in Burgundy. He does Pinot Noir and he does a fair bit of whole bunch, and that's where I first discovered that you can get that sort of different fruit character from a winemaking technique. Yeah, trying that with them on site last April, with some Plumpton colleagues as well. So that experience, and I genuinely believe as well that the way you enjoy a wine is so dependent on the experience. So trying that with some Plumpton friends, learning something new and it just tasting phenomenal is probably one of my best experiences in wine and one of my favorite.
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right about experience being such a key part of it. I can drink the same bottle of wine, you know, on my own as with a bunch of friends, and it genuinely doesn't taste as good if those friends are not there. So I totally buy into that. But congratulations again on being emerging talent in wine winner and the competition at the IWSC. As I say, it was very hotly contested. And it's really exciting what you're doing with Not Yet Named Wine Co. as well. So keep us posted on that. And good luck with your plans for Vintage 3.
Yeah, thank you very much. So I guess if anybody does want to sign up, you can go to our website, which is www.notyetnamedwineco.com. And there should be some information about Vintage 3 being released pretty shortly.
Very slick. You get your plug in as well. Well done, Alex. Thanks very much for joining us on The Drinking Hour.
Cheers. Thank you very much.
The Drinking Hour with David Kermode in partnership with Club Onologique. The world through the lens of wine and spirits.
Okay, let's round off as ever with some medal winners from the IWSC Hall of Fame. And this will be our last chance, I think, to visit the winners from 2022, because next week the winners from the process in 2023 will be revealed. Judging took place fortnight ago for 2 weeks, and it was a pretty intensive period. I know I was there judging on the panels. So stay tuned for the results from the 2023 judging process. But as I say, back to 22, and let's go to Chile first, as this was Alex's most recent vintage, as we heard. He doesn't obviously have any made wine yet, so he hasn't won any trophies as yet, but I'm sure they'll come. In the meantime, Casas del Bosque Pequeñas Syrah 2020 was a silver medal winner last year from a judging panel overseen by Alistair Cooper, MW, a guest here on the Drinking Hour talking Chile a while ago. The judges also included Emma Dawson, MW, an experienced retail buyer, Master Sommelier Matteo Montone, Elvis Ziakos, and Brazilian South American expert Paulo Brammer. And their tasting note for this Casas del Bosque Pequeñas Syrah 2020 says this: reminiscent of tapenade and salami, this is a complex wine with concentrated flavours, forest fruits, vegetal notes of menthol and eucalyptus, layered with smoky spices, lingers on the finish, and sounds savoury and delicious. Keeping it topical to what we've been talking about, let's go to Portugal next for an Alvarinho, or at least an Alvarinho blend, Quinta da Rasa Alvarinho Trashadora 2021, a silver medal winner. The judges here overseen by Irish Master of Wine Mick O'Connell, previous guest here on the Drinking Hour in the first series, I think. They said this: expressive green ripe fruit, skin aromas and flavours with creamy palate of green apple flesh, invigorating freshness with an attractive peach-laden finish. Good length and well structured. And I had the pleasure of a day judging Portugal this year. So do look out for the results from that in a week or so's time. Let's stay in Portugal for another white, a silver medal winner with a very respectable 92 points. Cabeça de Toro Reserva Terroir Fernão Pires 2021. The judges for this, overseen by Dirceu Viana Jr., MW, a Brazilian master of wine and a renowned expert on Portugal, amongst other countries. The tasting note from the judging team says this: ripe, creamy nose with stone fruit aromas on the palate. Orchard fruits, mango, papaya, and a hint of banana join the well-balanced, concentrated flavour mix for a long finish. To New Zealand next, because I was very impressed at the London Wine Fair this week by the New Zealand pop-up, which had some great wines. These are winners, as I mentioned, from 2022, and a strong silver for the Acorn Sauvignon Blanc 2021, produced by the Marlborough Grape Growers Cooperative. I was on the judging panel actually last year for this. Very high caliber of wines, as there was this year from Marlborough and right across New Zealand. And this is the tasting note for that wine winner last year of a silver medal. Delicate aromas of fresh lemon zest with bright intensity on the palate, notes of gooseberry, florals and white pepper are beautifully balanced and refined. And finally, to a place that I went very recently, I'm delighted to say, and there's a visit here coming up in a special edition of the Drinking Hour fairly soon. Catena Zapata Adriana Vineyard, designated Malbec 2019, a strong silver. This comes, as the name suggests, from the Adriana Vineyard, an altitude plot in Tupungatu province, right in the foothills of the Andes. Incredible place. The judges said this: a fruit-driven style with ripe black fruit, plum flavours and a spicy coconut-infused touch of oak. Medium weight and well-balanced with a long finish. There we go. Time for my own short finish now. That's it for this week's edition of The Drinking Hour. My thanks to Alex Brogan of Not Yet Named Wine Co. Do check out that site. He gave you the website address just now. It's a great idea, and he's got a real community that he's built there. So my thanks to Alex. My thanks to you for listening this week, and do join us next time here on The Drinking Hour. Bye for now.
The Drinking Hour with David Kermode in partnership with Club Onologique, the world through the lens of wine and spirits.
To find out more about Food FM and our content, go to foodfmradio.com.